It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
A part of Russia along Ukraine's border is under a state of emergency as Kyiv's offensive in Russia enters its second week. Ukraine says it has seized nearly 400 square miles of territory, making it the biggest foreign incursion into Russia since World War II.
This month, the war in Ukraine took a wild, unexpected turn. Ukrainian forces took the conflict onto Russian turf, breaking through thinly manned defenses in the country's Kursk region, capturing dozens of towns and villages, and throwing Vladimir Putin's military and security forces back on their heels. But at the same time, the Russians are intensifying the conflict in Ukraine itself, launching waves of drone strikes on civilian infrastructure and closing in on a key logistics hub in the eastern Donbass. What to make of the dizzying back and forth in a two-year-old conflict with seemingly no end in sight? We'll talk to a man uniquely situated to assess the conflict, how it got to this point, and where it's going. The former American ambassador to Russia, John Sullivan. Initially appointed by then-President Trump, he was then kept on in Moscow by the Biden administration to help formulate this country's response to Russia's February 2022 invasion, an act that, Sullivan writes in his new book, Midnight in Moscow, was as clear an example of an aggressive, illegal war as Germany's invasion of Poland in 1939, which set off World War II. We'll talk to Sullivan about the prospects for the war in Ukraine, as well as his personal upfront observations of Putin, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden on this episode of Spy Talk. Ambassador John Sullivan, welcome to Spy Talk. I want to congratulate you on a really gripping read in your book, Midnight in Moscow. It's rare to get such a candid, real-time view of policymaking in the midst of an international crisis, but you've given us that. You've got fascinating stuff to say about Vladimir Putin and both the presidents you work for, Donald Trump and Joe Biden. And I have to say, you've got some tough things to say about both of them. And we're going to get to that. But before we do, I want to start out with the recent developments in Ukraine. This month, we've got the Ukrainians invading Russia's Kursk region, even as the Russians make gains in eastern Donbass. Where is this headed?
Well, thanks, Michael. First, it's great to be with you. You're very kind to say those things about the book. Pardon me. If I were in Moscow, I would say that the FSB had tampered with my coffee.
here in DC, and this is my zapping bed. You with microwaves. Maybe we'll get into that later. Yeah,
kind of hard to switch out of that mindset. I'll offer one observation, though. Just talking about writing the book, I was advised by my friend General Paul Nakasone, who be now retired head of NSA, and he said that because of the positions I held in both in Washington and as ambassador, that the FSB would continue to monitor me. And in particular, when they discovered that I was writing a book, and they love it when government officials write books. And you think, well, the book is going to be reviewed, and mine was by the State Department, for any information that shouldn't be disclosed publicly. But the FSB wants to see it before it goes through the security review. So Paul warned me. He said, gosh, I hate it when you guys like you come out of government and write, because I write the book on my personal computer. I send it to the State Department. They made some edits, not many. But I always blame any technical glitches, I blame on the FSB.
But wait a second. This is fascinating. I hadn't thought about this before, but do you have reason to believe the FSB did access your book in its manuscript form before it was published?
I have no physical manifestations of that other than the point that General Nakasone made to me. And there isn't really that much to do about it. I couldn't go and write my book on a secure computer in a SCIF somewhere. So the government has to trust me. The U.S. government has to trust me that I wouldn't put something really sensitive in writing on a computer and then send it by email to them. But, you know, the FSB, DCRO-1, the section of the FSB, the counterintelligence section that monitors the U.S. mission to Russia, I believe there are over 7,000 officers assigned to smother. To be fair, it's North America, so it's the United States mission and the Canadian mission. But they got a lot of people working on it.
I got to say, Nakasone, having previously been head of NSA, probably knows how it's done and may well have done it himself.
He's keeping track of me, too.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, I digress from the...
All right, back to my question. Where are things headed in Ukraine and Russia right now?
Vladimir Putin would like to know. He was surprised by the incursion into Kursk. The homeland has been directly attacked with no quibbles about international law and whether Crimea or the Donbass are Russian territory. And this is going to further unite the Russian people behind the special military operation, the war against the West. Putin didn't want this to happen. It's an achievement by the Ukrainians. They're proud of it. It's going to be difficult for the Russians to expel the Ukrainians from this fairly large amount of territory now that they have seized. You know, since the last major territorial shift in the fall and early winter of 22, when the Russians collapsed around Kharkiv and then got kicked out of Kherson, this is the biggest change on the battlefield in territorial gains since then.
That said, though, I mean, as we pointed out, the Russians have stepped up their drone attacks on civilian infrastructure. I mean, some of the heaviest bombardments since the war began. They're making these gains in eastern Donbass. It's hard to see, who's getting the upper hand here, if anybody, or are we just looking, and I think you indicate this in your book, at what could be an endless war of attrition that goes on for years?
Yeah, I mean, whether or not the two militaries continue to engage in active combat, my view is it's going to be on a much larger scale. I've drawn on my Irish grandparents, my Irish heritage, Irish Republicans, I will add. My grandfather, when he filled out his census form in 1920, made clear that he had been born in the Irish Free State, which it was then called. But if you look at, Belfast and Ulster, provisional IRA, new IRA, and, the Protestant militias, they're still whacking each other. There are still walls up. This is going to be a bloody sore on the face of Europe for a long time to come. The Ukrainians aren't going to forgive and forget. So Putin is never going to surrender, as they say in the book, never surrender his objectives to denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. He may need a pause. But to get to your question, though, about, where does this go? And, we've got the Russians making modest gains in the Donbass. For Putin now, for as long as this incursion has gone on, and there hasn't been an effective response on the ground in Kursk to expel the Ukrainians, it's going to require a lot more effort by Putin and the Russian military and security services, which inevitably, and the Ukrainians will say this, inevitably drain resources that are necessary for the really modest gains they're making in the Donbass. So my prediction is we're going to head into, it's already basically September. This conflict, my prediction is next winter, things aren't going to look a whole lot different. I predict that there will be, the Russians will, as they've done throughout history, rally from the initial setback and swarm the invaders. So maybe the Ukrainians get pushed back, but I don't think there's going to be a big change between now and next spring.
Well, I mean, in the book, you indicate, you know, I think this war could go on for as long as a decade or more, which is pretty eye-opening. So let me ask you, you've obviously been a stalwart supporter of Ukraine and giving it the arms it needs to resist the Russians. But that's said, it's hard to see a strategy at this point that would dislodge Russia from Donbass and Crimea.
Right.
If that's the case, isn't the ultimate answer here some sort of diplomatic off-ramp that would likely accepting what is the reality on the ground? The Russians have seized a chunk of Ukraine and they have no intention of leaving.
Well, I think I would refer to what one of my former bosses, Mike Pompeo, has said, which is wrote an op-ed for, I believe it was the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago, and, you know, a potential Trump cabinet member speaking. And former Trump cabinet secretary, former Trump secretary of state, drawing the analogy to the Baltics and the United States never recognizing the legitimacy of the absorption into the Soviet Union of the three Baltic states. I can't imagine. I would never support or urge the United States to recognize the absorption of the four oblasts plus Crimea that Putin now maintains have by lawful means become part of the Russian Federation. I concede your point that it's difficult to imagine at this point the Ukrainians pushing the Russians out. But look at what they've done in Crimea. I mean, they've effectively pushed the Russian Navy out of Crimea, which was the principal reason why the Russians were so interested, Russian military was so interested in Crimea to have those naval ports. So, look, it is the ultimate point from my perspective is, and I talk a lot about in the book about support for Ukraine, arming Ukraine. I'm all for that. And when I hear my fellow Republicans, particularly members of Congress, who say things like, why are we defending Ukraine's borders? I don't care what happens to Ukraine. They're focusing on the wrong thing. The most important thing for the United States is to oppose Russian aggression. They're looking at the wrong side of the equation. If this were happening in Poland, Romania, Slovakia, Moldova, I'd be saying the same thing. It's not because I love Ukraine and love Ukrainians. I've been to Kyiv back when it was Kiev in the Soviet Union, or we called it, and I considered it a visit to the Soviet Union, not to the Ukrainian Soviet Republic. This is all about Russian aggression. It happens to be directed at Ukraine, which is why the point of the spear is sticking into Ukraine, but it won't end there. And I draw the analogies, many analogies in the book, to the Second World War and the start of the war in the 1930s and the late 30s. It's the equivalent And I have to be careful because I'm not saying Putin's Hitler, and I say this in the book, I'm not saying Putin's Hitler, and I'm not saying the Russian Federation is Nazi Germany. But there is a comparison to be made to an American saying in the summer of 1939, why do we care about Poland? All wars end in negotiations. Stop the bloodshed. Let's negotiate. In fact, if you look at what happened in the United Kingdom, and the UK came very close when Churchill gets selected as prime minister, there were many in the UK who thought, we really spare our country, no invasion, we got to negotiate with the Nazis, Lord Halifax, right? You got to be careful with historical analogies. It's not perfect, but that's the way I think of it. We've got to oppose Russian aggression, do all we can to oppose Russian aggression, because if they can do this, they can do anything.
Well, to continue just for a moment with the World War II analogies, under Lend-Lease, we provided the United Kingdom and Churchill's government with all the weapons that they needed, as much as the Roosevelt administration could.
We provided even more to the Soviet Union and to Stalin.
And to Stalin. Okay, so as you know, there is a critique that the Biden administration was too slow to provide offensive weapons such as F-16s to Ukraine that could, because of concerns that it could lead to an escalation that would provoke a nuclear response from Russia. You don't spend a lot of time on this in the book, but you do seem to endorse the view that the Biden White House was too slow, too timid, whatever the word you want to use, to give the Ukrainians what they needed. And it might have made a difference. Is that your view?
Particularly on the long-range fires, on the missiles, yes, it might have made a difference. M1A1 tanks, F-16s. Look, there's a question for each of these weapon systems. There are legitimate questions to be asked and answered in the U.S. government. Is this really an effective weapon system to begin with, right? There were arguments about the M1A1 tank, the fuel that it uses. Is it really right for the battle that's being fought in Ukraine? So when you get over that threshold and you're focused then on Putin's so-called red lines, my view was that, and I lay out some other examples in the book, not just about Ukraine, but about our diplomatic relations with the Russians, sort of on a smaller scale, about not provoking them, worried that they're going to close the U.S. embassy. So that's sort of small scale. Don't provoke the Russians because they'll close the embassy and we don't want to lose our embassy in Moscow. You scale that up on a larger scale to the war in Ukraine, and it's the same view that, we can't allow the Ukrainians to have these weapons that have this long reach into Crimea or into southwestern Russia, because God knows what Putin will do.
So let me ask you, as ambassador, as this invasion was happening and the conflict was growing, did you advocate to the Biden White House to provide some of these offensive weapons that it was not providing? Did you speak up on that?
Well, to the
extent, what kind of response did you get?
Well, so it was my perspective was, and you'll understand this, my perspective was as ambassador to Russia was focused on the Russian government and Putin. So my views would have been sought or listened to on how is Putin going to react? How is Russia going to react? And my view was that for some of these weapon systems, he's let slip the dogs of war. He cried havoc, and he's going to have to deal with, and he will understand that. And the analogies, and I point them out in the book, go back to the Cold War with the U.S. support for the Mujahideen in Pakistan and Afghanistan against the Soviet incursion into Afghanistan. And on the other hand, the Soviet support for North Vietnam and before that for North Korea, surface-to-air missiles that shoot down U.S. B-52 bombers. What's an indigenous, domestic capacity in North Vietnam to produce those missiles, Likewise, the jets that your North Vietnamese used to shoot down American aircraft and kill, they were not just provided by the Soviet Union. Many of them were flown by Soviet pilots. So there's a history of this, and Putin knows that. So I was not asked, should we send particular weapon systems to Russia? I was asked, if we were to, how would this, you know, how would the Russians react? And my view was that, yeah, Putin, his nuclear saber rattling, the fear, there were two fears, really. One was he would strike marshalling areas, weapons depots in Eastern Europe, in NATO territories. So there would be a strike on a NATO ally that would require a NATO response on the one hand. And then the second concern was the use of unconventional weapons, nuclear weapons, principally tactical, was the concern. So where I weighed in more forcefully was on our diplomatic relations and in trying to insist on reciprocity, and and the fear there being the Russians would close our embassy. And for your Spy Talk viewers, the issue is we have a mission to Russia. They have a mission to the United States. If we wipe those out, they still have a substantial presence in the United States with their mission to the UN. And so how does that leave us if that's where we get to? But that's a much more complicated, small ball diplomats and intelligence professionals debating how hard we push back.
We have to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. And we're back. Let's talk about Putin. You were up close and personal with him. You had a personal interview. You obviously watched him at multiple international conferences, G20s and such. You describe Putin as a Czechist.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
That's his self-description. He says himself he's a Czechist. He had a statue of Dzerzhinsky on his desk. I don't know if he still has it.
Tell us who Dzerzhinsky is and what the Cheka was.
So the Cheka was founded by Dzerzhinsky and Lenin at the start of the October Revolution in December of 17, as an extraordinary committee. The acronym is CHEKA, Cheka. And they were basically given authority, they empowered by Lenin and the Bolshevik revolutionaries to do anything that was necessary to protect the revolution and to bring down the opponents of the revolution. They weren't bound by law. They were bound by nothing other than promoting and protecting the revolution. The Cheka evolved an interesting footnote. Dzerzhinsky himself was a Pole, descended from Polish nobility. All of the historical anomalies with the interconnections between all of these peoples and countries, it's fascinating. The Cheka morphs over decades into the NKVD, KGB. The KGB then splits after the demise of the Soviet Union into a foreign intelligence service, which is the SVR, and the Federal Security Service, which is the FSB. And for our purposes, particularly talking about Ukraine, the FSB, in effect, is the Foreign Intelligence Service for what the Russians call their near abroad, all of the former Soviet republics. So the Cheka, Czechists, the Czechist mindset, that's what Putin identifies with. Those, the original leaders of the Czechists, who were not bound by law, they were committed to basically protecting the state by whatever means they could. And they draw inspiration from Ivan the Terrible and the Oprichniki. You know, centuries before, the Oprichniki, sorry for this history digression, but it's important to understand the way Putin views this. The Oprichniki, they were bound only by their oath to Ivan the Fourth, Ivan the Terrible. They could do anything for the Tsar. There was no law, nothing. And they were famous for wearing black leather tunics, which is why the Cheka and then all of their subsequent predecessors were infamous for wearing long black leather coats.
So tell us how you're in your own dealings with Putin, how you saw that Cheka persona manifest itself.
He's got incredible self-discipline, which is always attributed to, and I mean down to his facial expressions, which is why I thought it was interesting in June of last year. It's one of the few times I've really seen him. This is during the Prigozhin mutiny, where his KGB training, he wasn't able to, present this image of self-control. I'm in charge here, which KGB officers were, prided themselves on their ability to, no matter the situation, to be in control of their emotions and their facial expressions. He's remarkably calm, cool. I cite examples in the book, and it goes to Biden's meeting with Putin in Geneva in June of 2021. And Putin was as relaxed as you can imagine. He was cracking jokes. He was very calm. I look back on it now, and I think this was a guy who felt very confident in what he was about, what he was about and about to do in June of 21. Because months later, he's going to launch the special military operation, right? Based on his accusation that the United States has started a war against Russia in Ukraine. He has the opportunity to discuss this with the president of the United States face-to-face in Geneva, never talks about it. It's cracking jokes, putting everybody at ease. That's a Czechist right there.
So let's talk about the two presidents you worked for, because you're kind of in a unique position. In fact, I was trying to think, and you may know the answer to this, is there another political appointee from Donald Trump who stayed on in their position under Joe Biden, other than you?
Just a handful. Roger Karstens, who's the special presidential envoy for hostage affairs, great guy, good friend of mine, and it's technically the case of a political appointee being held over. But if you know David Satterfield, Ambassador Satterfield was our ambassador to Turkey, and then by the Biden administration, Secretary Blinken brought him back. To be, first of all, they kept him as ambassador to Turkey for a time. But he's a career Foreign Service officer. He resigned from the Foreign Service to take a position with the UN monitoring mission in the Sinai. When we brought him back, we wanted to bring him back quickly. We brought him back as a political. Okay. So the short answer to your question is probably no one at my level, deputy secretary, ambassador to Russia level, certainly was bridged, from the Trump administration.
That's right. And I should point out, you started out not as ambassador to Moscow in the Trump administration. You were deputy secretary of state to Rex Tillerson, the number two official in the State Department. But as you point out in the book, and as you referred to earlier, you're a lifelong Republican. You get appointed by a Republican president. But you repeatedly point out or underscore a critique that has been quite common. In fact, it was Nikki Haley's principal theme when she was running against Donald Trump for the Republican nomination this year, the chaos that just surrounded his administration. Page 29, you talk about the chaos under Donald Trump. Page 35, the chaos and unpredictability. Stress, page 39, stress and disorder. Right. Page 41, undisciplined machinations of the Trump White House. Given that, can you support your party's nominee for president this year?
So I did not support President Trump in the Republican primaries. In fact, I supported my former colleague and our former ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley. Look, I think the choices, the choice that's being presented to the American people in November, I don't support either candidate. I'm going to have to vote for one. And that calculation is something that, you know, it's difficult for me. I've said it before that I'm a lifelong Republican, and that's always been my, I was about to say the word default, but that's not the case. I was an enthusiastic voter for Republican presidents, starting with Reagan in 80. If and when I vote for Trump in November of 2024, it's only because I believe it's my duty to vote, and it's a binary choice, Harris versus Trump. But you know what, Michael, the my perspective on this, and it comes, it's something I talk about in the book. This, the type of political division we have in the United States today, which is pretty bad, as bad as it's certainly been in my lifetime. We're not approaching the 1860 election, but it's bad. That's catnip to the Kremlin. The right. fact that we can't have a civilized, even modest, even on a modest basis, civilized political dialogue. I mean, in some sense, Putin really doesn't care. I mean, Putin could care less about Trump or Harris, Republicans or Democrats. What he really thrives on is division in the United States. And ultimately, what he wants is, and I've talked to my friend H.R. McMaster, who's written a book recently about.
He's got his own book right now. Yeah.
Our experiences in the Trump administration. He wants to crush our hope in the future. He wants us to think, we Americans to think, we are as bad, we are the same as he and his checkers and his country.
Okay, but Ambassador, some would say that your critique of Trump in this book, chaos, unpredictability, undisciplined, only adds, contributes to that which Vladimir Putin wants, which is to stir up discord in this country. So just back to my question, I want to press you a little bit. You kind of wavered. I mean, are you leaning towards voting for Donald Trump this time or Kamala Harris? Or are you truly one of those undecided voters that both camps are targeting their messages?
I get asked this question all the time. My default, as I've said now, is to continue the voting trend I've had for 44 years of voting for the Republican nominee. But when there's a difference between, I at least draw the distinction between wanting to vote and participating in our democracy and making the binary choice between two candidates and supporting Trump. You ask me if people ask me if I support Trump, no. And that's what's clear in my book. It's my concerns with a Harris presidency. They are what I think. What my uncertainty reflects, given how I feel about President Trump, is how much concern I have about a Harris presidency for the future of the United States.
All right. Well, we'll get to that. But let's talk about Biden for a moment, because you are also really tough on him in some parts, particularly starting with the pullout from Afghanistan. And you write, the blow to American credibility and standing was in some ways immeasurable. Our chaotic, deadly, and dishonorable withdrawal from Afghanistan ripped open those wounds. And while Americans were debating loudly among themselves who was at fault, Trump or Biden or both, the Russians were making their own assessments and planning accordingly. You seem to be arguing there that the pullout from Afghanistan may have contributed or did contribute to Putin's decision to invade Ukraine.
Yeah, so two things. I try to draw this out briefly in the book. I mean, the Afghanistan withdrawal is one in a series over decades, basically over my lifetime, going back to Vietnam through to, Iraq WMD, you name it. American credibility has really taken many hits over time. So when I write about opening old wounds, that's what I'm talking about. And I don't suggest that Putin decides, because remember this, what happened, it was just the anniversary of the terrorist attack at Aitz Kaya was just a few days ago in August. When Putin meets with Biden in June of 21, they talked about Afghanistan. Biden brought it up. The United States, as you'll recall, was looking for counterterrorism platforms in the region in Central Asia. And that was a topic. They spent more time talking about Putin and Biden, Afghanistan, and the counterterrorism mission that the United States wanted to continue in the region than they did about Ukraine. So it's part of, it's part of the milieu in which Putin decides, to launch the special military operation. It was not my contention that it was a decisive factor. What was, I think, more significant was the general perception of American credibility, America as a stalwart who's going to stand by its principles come what may. Afghanistan was just the most recent example of America from some perspective cutting and running.
You mentioned Vice President Harris before. You were obviously, as you write in the book, participated in multiple phone calls, secure phone calls with the National Security Council and the White House throughout the run-up to the invasion and after the invasion took place itself. Did Vice President Harris participate in these calls and meetings you were a part of? And if so, what role did she play?
Well, she participated as Vice President in the NSC meetings that I was patched into by secure video teleconference from Moscow, and that I've never met the vice president in person or spoken to her directly. I spoke to the president, not just in person and in connection with the Geneva meeting, but on the NSC, those NSC video conferences, but never with the vice president.
Did she speak up at all? Did she express viewpoints? Did she participate?
I don't really have a firm memory of her expressing strong views on issues. She probably spoke. I just don't have a memory of it. There are a lot of people weighing in: SecDef, SecState, the chairman, the president, National Security Advisor. She was one of those voices.
So a big part of the American response and the Western response was, in addition to providing military aid to Ukraine, severe sanctions on the Russians, on their economy, designed to basically cripple them and make them unable to sustain the war effort. Here we are 2.5 years later, and the Russian economy seems to be doing okay. Obviously, oil revenues help a lot. But it does seem to raise questions about just how effective these sanctions have been. Your view?
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to start with, acknowledge first that the special military operation is continuing. It's not, Putin hasn't changed his goals for the special military operation, which is denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. One thing in observing the Russians and Putin, not just in the run-up to the war, but from years before, they have had a lot of experience with U.S. sanctions. So what's interesting is to look at it from Putin's perspective. He was asked not long after the war began, why now? Why did you these problems in Ukraine that you've identified, the genocide, why did you wait so long? And he said, we weren't ready. And looking back now, as I look back, it was not just his restoring the Russian military. It was preparing Russia for what he thought would be significant sanctions by the West. He wasn't sure of the scope and the scale. They wound up being bigger and more pervasive than he probably anticipated. But a major part of the Russian preparation for this war was preparing the Russian economy, sources of technology, et cetera, that would enable a Russian economy to survive the sanctions that they knew were coming.
So that said, it does suggest that perhaps the Biden administration oversold the sanctions as a retaliatory response to what the Russians were doing.
I don't know if I would characterize it that way. It was a necessary but not sufficient response to deter in the first place. The threat wasn't, Putin wasn't going to be deterred. As I write in the book, I was with Ambassador Burns, Director Burns, when he traveled to Moscow in early November of 21 and made the threat about substantial sanctions. They were not going to be deterred by this. Just as the Russians were surprised by the scope of the sanctions, I'll give you one example. It's not a sufficient economic blow to the Russians, but it was a political blow that they didn't expect. The Swiss imposed sanctions. They didn't expect that. They really didn't like that.
How much did it hurt them?
Well, it hurt their. It hurt them.
What, does Putin have like Swiss bank accounts?
No. The mindset is about respect for Russia. The fact that the Swiss impose sanctions now means the Russians love Putin and Biden met in Geneva. They love to meet in Geneva. They won't go to Geneva anymore. They were hurt. They're sensitive. They were hurt.
One last issue I want to cover before we wrap up, which you developed after your book was finished. You talk a lot about Americans detained in Russia, particularly you write about Paul Whelan and your efforts to get him out. There was a swap. This summer, both Whelan, Gershkovich, and others were released in exchange for the guy Putin really wanted back, which is the KGB, the FSB assassin in Germany. Obviously everybody is glad that the Americans completely wrongfully detained were released. But there is an argument that these sort of exchanges just encourage further hostage taking by a Czechist such as Vladimir Putin. Your perspective on whether this was the right move at the right time?
Yeah, so you're undoubtedly correct. It should be self-evident that making a trade like this is not going to discourage Putin from treating Americans the way he has been. But it's even worse than that, and I'll give you an example. It also undermines cooperation with the United States by other countries. So if we have a Russian extradited from a country, let's say there's a Russian criminal, serious criminal, the United States wants him, and he's arrested in country X. And country X has an extradition treaty with the United States. He's arrested in country X. The United States initiates the process to extradite. The Russians put enormous pressure on country X, inducements, threats. We try to persuade country X, extradite that Russian to us. Victor Boot was extradited from Thailand. Yaroshenko was extradited from Liberia. If we then trade, if we that country resists, country X resists that pressure, extradites them to the United States, the Russians retaliate against them however they want, and then we trade that person after they've been through our criminal justice system for something, and this is from the other country's perspective, something we want, which is Americans being released. In the future, when we go back to country X and say, we want that Russian extradited, they're going to say, why would we extradite him to you? We want something from the Russians. We'll do our deal with the Russians. Forget about our extradition treaty. So there are serious consequences to making these types of deals. Having said all that, if you ask me, would I have made the deal? I probably would have felt the same way President Biden felt when he had families in the Oval Office, whether it was Trevor Reed's parents, Paul Whelan's family, Brittany Griner's family. It's enormously difficult for an American leader, an American president to resist getting those Americans home, even if it means giving up these Russian criminals.
So you would have counseled the president to do the deal that he did?
Well, I, as ambassador, I was involved in the conversations. A number of things go into these decisions. Among them, the health and well-being of the American. Is that person sick? You know, Russian labor camps and prisons are notoriously bad places for one's health, tuberculosis, AIDS, et cetera. Mental health, you know, there's a lot. If a person is about to expire, that increases the urgency. And we try to keep pretty careful track on it's difficult for us, but, you know, I would offer facts. And I remember many times thinking to myself, I'm glad I don't have to make this decision because it's a tough one. Can I offer one more fact about Paul Whelan? I had a conversation with him the other day. I spent some time, so much time, which you will appreciate given your background. And I had forgotten this and I didn't include it in the book. So I visited him a lot, both in La Fortiva prison before he was tried and convicted, and then in the labor camp where he was detained, IK 17. My first meeting with him in La Fortiva with an FSB colonel sitting between us, and everything we said had to be translated for the colonel. Anything I said before Paul could respond had to be translated for the colonel, and he'd nod, and Paul could respond. Paul said to me, we had just met, and he said to me, he wanted to make one thing clear to me. And he said, there's no blue dress. And you can imagine.
Explain the context, please.
Imagine what, so the Russian colonel, yeah. I can only imagine, like, God, you know, what they think about us. Well, these two Americans are talking about wearing a dress. Go figure, these Americans. He did, you know, I'm sure they would figure it out eventually. The reference to, of course, Monica Lewinsky and, you know, Bill
but
Clinton.
I'm a little unclear. What was he trying to say there?
No, I didn't do it. I'm not a spy. There's no evidence that any evidence that they've got against me is fab. There's no blue
got it. There's no DNA evidence of his espionage. Right, right.
Paul also said in our first conversation that he had never visited the Detroit Institute of Art. And I had to think about that one for a while, and DIA. And he was saying that he didn't work for the DIA because the Russians were accusing him of, at that point, being a Marine. They knew he had served in the Marine Corps, and it offended Paul that they kept calling him a soldier. He said, no, I'm a Marine. And the Russians didn't seem to appreciate that.
So the DIA, which he called the Detroit Institute of...
Detroit Institute of Art.
Of Art, DIA. Of right. Art, which doesn't actually exist.
I don't believe so. And that was to say, look, I'm not a spy. I'm not with DNA. There's no evidence that I'm a spy. There's no blue dress. I've never been to DIA.
Got it.
The reason he had to talk that way was the FSB colonel wouldn't have let him say it. It would have said, shut up, don't say that.
Right.
So this was Paul's code. But now that he's back, we're trading stories about our visits together. He promised to make me a hat. Among the things that they manufacture at IK-17, the labor camp where he was detained, the laborers produce hats, you know, the big furry hats that are used by Russian government officials, military, the security services. And Paul was wearing one during one of our meetings, and I commented on it, and he said he had made it himself, and I asked him to make one for me, and he said he would. But in our conversation the other day, he said he had made it for me, but that the Russians wouldn't let him take anything like that with him when they finally released him.
Well, on that somewhat amusing note to a very tragic overall story.
Although with a good ending now that he's
out. Yeah, that was a very good ending. All right, Ambassador Sullivan, I really want to thank you for both a really fascinating talk and and as I mentioned, a gripping read, Midnight in Moscow, a memoir from the front lines of Russia's war against the West. Thanks for joining us on Spy Talk.
It was my pleasure.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.com news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, high up MAGA guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar. Available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.